My name is Gary Rubin, and I'm lucky to be a lifetime congregant here at Neves Shalom. Rabbi Stamfer was at my bar mitzvah here. Rabbi Isaac officiated at my daughter's benot mitzvahs. Rabbi Kozak, we will see.
If you are a little bit worried about the bris the first time around,
it was fine. I'm here as a representative of a task force that was started 2 years ago to explore relational Judaism and how we can bring that concept here to Neves Shalom and what we can do with all of the touch points along the way with our congregants to have more of a relationship building between you and our shul. I hope over the past 2 years you've maybe noticed some differences in the chronicle, in our social media activity, and in some events like today, where we are moving beyond just the study of Judaism, but also what it means to be a congregant here at Neves Shalom. Today's discussion was prized to participate in a discussion, and we were thrilled with the idea, and we've run with it. This is just one activity related to discussions between our senior rabbis. We will have some video presentations in the future from another session that we filmed that explore what these senior rabbis have gone through and what they hope to go through and how they've led here at Congregation Neves Shalom. You will see some bright green cards scattered throughout. Those are meant for questions. If something pops into your mind during this presentation, please jot it down on the card. We'll be walking through and gathering those cards, and we'll save about 30 minutes at the end of the presentation for some of those questions to be read and addressed by our rabbis here. So I hope you enjoy today's discussion. We are very lucky to have three generations of senior rabbis at our shul, and they bring lots of wealth and knowledge and history about our congregation in the past, in the present, and in the future. So enjoy today's discussion.
Thank you, Gary. Rabbis Isaac and Stamfer and I had the wonderful opportunity to have a dry run of this last Thursday in my office, and we're hoping that the best conversation didn't take place then. One of the topics that we did not address that came up at the end of our time was surrounding rabbinical school. And when one first gets out for the first 5, 6, 7 years, however much it is, people often ask, like an old Jewish joke, why did you become a rabbi, or did rabbinical school prepare you for the real world? After time, people stop asking you that question, but today I'm going to ask that of my two senior colleagues, because one of the things that has changed along with the Jewish world is rabbinic education itself. So how did your rabbinical education prepare you, and in what ways did it not for what you would find?
Not too well, but we did the best we can.
My perspective, actually
I didn't know there was another sentence coming.
Actually, I thought that I had been asked practically any question I could imagine over the years that I have served. But last week, my granddaughter, Ariella, asked me a question that I never thought about before. And I'm going to start my answer with this question. She said, "Saba, what was the most important decade of your life to you?" Quite a few decades I had to think about. And But almost immediately, I gave her my answer. The 1940s. My whole life changed during that decade. When the decade began, I was a student at the University of Chicago studying biochemistry. And was looking forward to a career in that field. During the 1940s, my dream came true, and I got a job doing research chemistry in the synthetic rubber field in Akron, Ohio, where my father and family were living. And I looked forward to doing that for the rest of my life. Then in 1943, I went to Brandeis Camp Institute in Winterdale, Pennsylvania, which was established by the Zionist organization to develop Zionist leadership in those very momentous days before the creation of the State of Israel. I spent a month at Brandeis Camp. I met Goldie there. I was one of 53 campers at Brandeis Camp. There were three women and 50 men.
No, the other way.
That was
the other way around.
Gan Eden.
No, the other way around. Not 50 men and three women, the other way around.
No, the other way around, that's right. It was three men and 50 women. That was during the war years.
Depends who you are, how good the odds looked, right?
Anyway, that certainly changed my life. I came under the influence of wonderful Zionist leaders and began to rethink my career. Finally, after Goldie and I were married in 1944, both of us decided that I was going to become a rabbi and devote myself to the Jewish people and their future. While there at the seminary in 1947, we went to study in Israel. Both of us were in the Haganah and participated in the War of Independence with the State of Israel, which meant that the focus of my life would forever afterwards be on Israel. And then in 1949, I became a rabbi. So the 40s changed every part of my living. All of that was before we came to Portland, Oregon. The fact that I was the son of a rabbi actually played a negative role in my decision, because the one thing that I was sure of growing up, I'll never ever become a rabbi. But that's how life turned out.
So, Rabbi Isaac, how about some of your experiences with that rabbinical school?
Born in 1949, it would be peculiar for me to say that the 40s were the best decade for me. But in fact, one of the things that I realized when we sat this last week, Rabbi Stamfer grew up in a rabbinic home. His father was a rabbi. Rabbi Kosak, his grandfather was a rabbi. So he grew up, to some degree, My father was a plasterer. A plasterer because his education was interrupted because of Nazi Germany. So I had a different vantage point about going to the seminary. My closest friend was the son of the rabbi in San Francisco, and I was enamored by the kinds of things he was involved with. Well, the seminary was a completely different place. The seminary was an institute that didn't prepare you for dealing with people. It didn't prepare you for life cycle events. It didn't prepare you even for leading Shabbat services. It was a place of scholarship. And not only a place of scholarship, but a place where, and perhaps this is the same in many professional schools, where there was almost a disparagement of the product that the seminary was turning out. Because the seminary, for the most part, was not turning out scholars. It was turning out individuals who studied Talmud, people who were immersed in the texts, but not people who did research all of their lives, like most of the professors. And I think that's changed. I think it's probably changed at the seminary, and I think it's probably changed at the UJ as well. In terms of an understanding and appreciation for the profession that they were producing, people who would be in congregations, leading the Jewish community. So in many ways, the education at the seminary helped in a sense of introducing all kinds of Jewish literature, Jewish documents, ways of study, but not practical ways in becoming a congregational rabbi.
So I'll take a moment. It's a very interesting question, and Rabbi Stamp, for your comment about your first career brought to mind one of the lessons which, like you, may have discouraged me from becoming a rabbi. My grandfather would tell me stories of what being a congregational rabbi were really, what it was really like. And one of the really sweet stories was one day on Shabbat afternoon, a congregant comes to my grandfather's house with an automobile tire and says, "Rabbi, my son stole this from a tire store where it was displayed outside, and I want you to return it." That's sort of what the rabbinate is like in the real world.
I had here the experience where someone turned in a gun. I had no idea whether it had been used in a crime, not. And now, here, Rabbi, take care of it. They didn't train us in rabbinical school for that either.
But at Brandeis Berdeen, you got some good firearm lessons with that. So I, like you, I had perhaps a little bit close exposure to what that meant to be a rabbi and the stories of that tire, and there were many other stories similar to that one that my grandfather told. But for me, and coming to it as a second career as well, I wanted the scholarship, and I wanted a yeshiva sort of experience, because though I woke one day and had this epiphany of becoming a rabbi and have been faithful to that epiphany, I was hungry to understand my tradition. So much of Jewish identity hinges on books and works that the average person, and I was one of those, had no access to. There's a lot more translations now, but I wanted, you know, part to be a rabbi, in addition to all the pressures of modernity and what that means to build community and relationships, as Gary started us off with, there's some sense of wisdom and continuity between we who are here today, even with, you know, 100 years of rabbinic experience between us, and people 2,000 years ago, that in some ways the basics of human life have not changed, and that this ancient wisdom can continue to reverberate. And while that may not tell you about a boardroom or a budget, it certainly for me was an important, if side, aspect of what rabbinical school prepared me for. It gave me the basis of any rabbinic authenticity and authority has to come from our connection to our ancestors, that we are all links in a chain. So I want to go a very different way, and this was not a question we discussed last week, but it occurred to me, we've been talking about change in the rabbinate, in duties, and in our time together separately, independently of here. What has been the role of politics in your rabbinic career? And let me frame that a little bit. Certainly in earlier generations, Judaism or Jews were considered to be a subset of the Democratic Party. Over the years, in part because American Jews were immigrants, and that was understood to be a party that represented that experience. And we've been in America a lot longer, and Jewish political identity has changed, our notions of what we want from the rabbi have changed, and yet Judaism has always been about the interface of our values with a public marketplace, that if Judaism is anything, it tells us how do we go about living in this world, and this world is to some degree an expression of political action because humans are social creatures. So how has politics played a role in your years?
Well, I'm assuming that we're not talking about politics in the general sense of elections or parties or anything like that. The politics of a Jewish community that I encountered when I came to Portland I came in 1953, was a different kind of politics. It was protecting turf. That was Jewish politics. There were Jewish organizations in Portland. Each one had laid out a turf, an area in which they were going to be serving the community, and they were dominant. And for a number of years, I'm just sharing with you what happened to me in Portland in the early 50s and in the 60s that I've long forgotten. First of all, when I came to Portland to Ahav Shalom, I did not have a grand plan for building a great congregation and establishing a significant Jewish community. I came as a rabbi, as a husband, as a father, and I had immediate needs. My most immediate needs were to make sure that my children would have a good Jewish education and life here in Portland. And I found out that as soon as I started to implement what I believed in, I faced a lot of opposition in terms of turf. Let me give you some examples. Some of the things that I'm rather known for in my activities in Portland. Some are familiar to you, some probably not. One of the first things that I wanted to do coming to Portland, I wanted my children to go to a Jewish camp. I met Goldie at Brandeis Camp. I realized how important Jewish camping could be in shaping Jewish life. There was a Jewish camp, and I went down to register my son Shaul in that camp, BB Camp. And as I've said publicly, I tremendously admire BB Camp primarily for one reason, because they've changed so much over the years. But when I came down to register him, talked about the fees and the activities and so on, and the director said to me, by the way, you probably know that we're not kosher. So I said, well, how can I send my son to a non-kosher camp? Why don't you make it kosher? And his answer, as I vividly remember, was, it never penciled out. It just didn't pay. For the amount of kids that would come because it was kosher, didn't pay for all the expense that it involved. Well, I thanked him. Not effusively, but I thanked him for his time. And I said, well, my son is going to go to a Jewish camp. And that's when I started working. Almost the first thing coming to Portland was to establish Camp Solomon Schechter. We had a two younger children. And in Lincoln, Nebraska, one of the first things that I did as rabbi there was to establish a preschool, a Jewish education preschool. So, started to work on developing the foundation school. But there was a Jewish preschool already right across the street. They had established a TERF. The center had a preschool. And right away, opposition arose. How can you start doing this when you've got a Jewish preschool right across the street at the Jewish Community Center? Well, it was a wonderful school. Helen Gordon was the director of it. She became widely known throughout the region for her leadership in that area of education. As a matter of fact, the school now is part of Portland State University and is named the Helen Gordon Preschool. So I said to my board, what's Jewish about it? It's a great preschool. There's nothing Jewish that's going on there that I can detect. I want a preschool where they learn Hebrew, where they learn prayers, where they celebrate holidays and so on. And we began that preschool. The congregation agreed to it on one condition. It has to financially maintain itself. We're not going to be spending extra money for the preschool. And sure enough, in 1 year, the school went broke. And it was a terrible disappointment to me. And the president of the congregation, Louis Rosenberg, came up to me and he said, Rabbi, I want to tell you that school will continue. One way or another, we're going to continue that school regardless, because it's so important. It's a foundation school for Jewish living. And that's exactly what happened. But it wasn't a slam dunk by any means.
Great. So we get the notion, certainly, of politics for you was how do you build Jewish life when there may have been resistance or pre-existing structures which didn't fulfill that. And I'm looking at your kippah, Rabbi Isaac, and I'm wondering if you would answer the question in the same way or have a slightly different take on that.
Let me give you just one more example, and then we'll go ahead with that. I was primarily interested in youth education. That was our future. So I began United Synagogue Youth. And there again, here you have a youth group of the synagogue, but we have already AZA and BBG. Why do we need another one? Overexpansion. My own congregation found difficulties in that because the other represented community-wide Jewish education. You don't have to split the community even more by having different congregations and have different youth groups. But there again, my point was, I was concerned about the essential Jewishness of their program. And there's plenty of room for a whole wide variety of Jewish youth programs in the community. But it was all turf and protecting turf. So that's the kind of Jewish politics that we had to engage in.
Okay, thank you.
You mean this kippah?
That kippah, yeah.
I don't know where I found it. It's a Hillary Clinton kippah. How is that? So, I could answer that question in so many different ways. One of the things that I think happened through my rabbinate is that probably starting in the 60s, a response to the Holocaust by the Jewish community was that Friday night services were a time for rabbis to talk about not internal politics, but to talk about anti-Semitism, talk about civil rights, talk about bigotry, talk about the Vietnam War, talk about Soviet Jewry. These were the topics of it would seem to me almost every American rabbi spoke about Friday night and perhaps even Saturday morning. Something really happened in the 80s. In many ways, the agenda. I think two things happened. First of all, the agenda changed. The agenda changed because Soviet Jewry wasn't an issue any longer. The agenda changed because while civil rights is again at the top of our agenda, civil rights lost its place. The Vietnam War ended. Somehow that whole political agenda disappeared. And what came in its place is a sense that that came either from rabbis or from the community. We don't want to talk about politics anymore. Let's talk about spirituality. Well, I got to tell you, that's a big transition, especially since who the hell knows what spirituality is all about? You know, what does that really mean, spirituality? In many ways, spirituality is almost a more selfish kind of endeavor. It's, you know, what is there that God is going to do for me? So that was very hard. I think the other thing that happened, and perhaps should have mentioned before, is the Jewish community progressively has become more and more an educated community. There was a time when the Jewish community were, for the most part, they were not necessarily college educated. Certainly not educated with graduate degrees, and many of them for probably through much of Rabbi Stanford's tenure were middle class shop owners, etc. But now we're dealing with a community where rabbis have to be very careful what they talk about, because whatever topic we come up with that's not very directly from the text, there are experts out there who know more than we do, who have more expertise. And so you have to be very careful. Not that, you know, you don't want your congregants to walk out and say, "Ugh, that rabbi, he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about." So that's changed, I think, changed a lot in the sense that we have a kind of expertise in the Jewish community that's probably unparalleled in any other community in terms of the kind of education, the kind of degrees in law, in medicine, in the university, which I think changes, in a sense, how we deal with this subject. No one wants the rabbi to quote for them the newspaper and the New York Times. We have to assume everybody's read that. Everybody knows that. Now what are we going to talk about in terms of, is there a Jewish approach to some of these topics?
Great. I guess I should probably try to address it myself. And one of the things that it seems to me has happened, not only in the Jewish community, but in America as a whole, is the breakdown of discourse. And, you know, you don't need to read the newspapers even to pick up on that at this point. And so certainly for me, and I'm in the early parts of helping us as a community, there is a metapolitics, which is how do we talk and share difference in a real way, not in a way which is about overcoming the other person. Rabbi David Wolpe, one of my teachers, once talked about his wife being present when the Wolpe boys and dad, Gerald Wolpe, one of the great pulpit rabbis, were all arguing over some point. And on their way home, she turned to him and said, you know, just because you won the debate doesn't mean you're right. We're in a time where winning the debate really seems to be about it and not the ability to listen. So it seems to me that for me, because this is a problem in the Jewish community as well as the larger community, the metapolitics, the groundwork of politics in our days, actually, how do we communicate? How do we talk? How do we share deeply from our own values without an attempt to convince someone else? Because we already know that doesn't work, and we already know it confirms people's biases. And if we are to be a community in a way that matters, and a nation that matters, being able to actually share something authentic is the way that we build real relationships and real friendships. And so I certainly see, right, this a very, even in this flow of the years, a drastic change in what politics mentioned, and from the beginning of an issue of turf, and also an absence of institutional Judaism, right? There may have been a model, but there were long decades where Jewish activity had to be building a home, a foundation for us. And so much of your rabbinate, Rabbi Stanfer, was about building that home for us, right? And as we became more comfortable, as I see it, in our American identity, in being Jews in America, we got to turn to these larger sorts of issues. And now we're in a place where everything's falling apart, and how do we make sure that we're connected? And if you want to talk about a community based on relationship, that's the work that we have to do. And I believe that if we do that very deeply and well, that we can transform the world, that our politics, it seems ridiculous to say, but I deeply hold that, our politics is to share what we believe in a deep way that is not attempting to make someone else wrong, since that doesn't commit, but a way to share who we are. And if you do that, then God, I think, can be seen.
And certainly that which has become much more complicated is any conversation we have about Israel. Mm-hmm. We are very conflicted about Israel. I would like to say we are Zionists, we are lovers of Israel, and yet we find everything much about Israel very complicated. And how do we there are seminars now that on how can rabbis talk about Israel, because Israel is such, whatever position you take, whatever you try to support, you're going to alienate a whole section of your congregation, of the community, and it's in a way today, a discussion about Israel among American Jews is much more complicated than it's ever been before.
I think that's definitely true. I just want to put us on pause for a second. If people have questions, if you can spend the next 5 to 8 minutes getting those questions done, the moderators will begin to collect the green cards at that point. So I'll let people just think about that and get their thoughts down on paper. So I know when you and I, Rabbi Stanford, had a question, had another exchange earlier, you were talking about Israel and the one-state solution, which you now support. Can you succinctly sort of tell us why you've come to that opinion and what that means?
Well, this is a very long and complicated issue.
I know, that's why I said succinctly.
But bear with me for a few moments.
That means it won't be succinct, right?
First of all, I want to go back to the first thing that I talked about, namely being in Israel in 1947 and in 48, and literally, physically, being involved in the creation of the State of Israel. The memory of that event is, to say the least, an indelible memory in my mind. It was the fulfillment of a dream that even at the moment seemed impossible. I've shared with you some of these memories over the years. Just think back to 1947, 1948. Israel was surrounded by governments that were hostile, Arab governments. All of them had armies. All of them had artilleries. All of them had air forces. All of them had the tools of war. And I can remember personally what Israel had at that time. When I was in training for the Haganah, and just before the war broke out, there were about, in our particular company, of about 50 young Jews, male Jews, who were being simultaneously taught how to shoot a rifle. It should be simple, but it was so complicated. Because the 50 people that we were had at least 45 different kinds of rifles from different countries. Each one of them worked differently. As we were training, I remember how individual guns would suddenly go off in the tent. Somebody had forgotten to push this button or to pull that button. This is an army that was going to fight a war of independence. Simply unbelievable that it was even undertaken. But it happened, and miraculously, Israel emerged as a state. And look at it today in military terms. Certainly, among the five strongest military machines in the world, including everyone, China, United States, Russia. So, I believed, like everyone in my group, that there was something so special about Israel. The mere fact of its coming to life and emerging from the Holocaust and becoming a powerful, though small, nation was miraculous. Nevertheless, despite every success that it had, it continued to face implacable enemies. And so one war after another was fought. Then came 1967, that overwhelming victory again of Israel. And I was one of a very large group of Jews all over the world who believed that finally there was an opportunity for peace between Israel and its neighbors. Israel had now acquired huge areas of land, the immense Sinai Peninsula, the West Bank, areas in which there were hardly any Jews living under Israeli control. Couldn't that mean that we could be prepared to exchange this land that we didn't need, that we didn't want, for peace? Every logic dictated that result, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen. So I remember the first time that I declared myself in favor of a two-state solution, right here in this hall, to a congregation, actually about the same number as we have right now, and said, enough is enough. We've won this huge territory. Let's join in a peace effort to exchange land for peace. That's the essence of the two-state solution, which made every good sense in the world. So I was involved in Peace Now and active here in Portland in the Interreligious Committee for Peace in the Middle East. All of you know all of that. We still had, in our community, ultra-loyalists for Israel, who I remember in the Portland Jewish Review and even in the Oregonian, publicly stated that I was a traitor to Israel because I advocated that approach. But I persisted, and we did develop a lot of programs of that nature. But to make a long story short...
I'm confused by that statement.
The day has come when I will publicly admit, I don't believe that a two-state solution will happen or will work. And I don't lay the blame on either Israel or the Palestinians. They're both partially to blame. Israel went ahead and continues to build settlements that make it virtually impossible for a feasible Palestinian state. It would all be cut off. And on the other hand, Hamas ultranationalism in the Muslim world has resulted in the kind of wars that are going on in Syria and so many parts of the Middle East. In Palestine itself, there is no indication whatever that they are prepared to create a Palestinian state. So, as much as I would, and I still believe that a two-state solution is an ideal solution, but it's not going to happen. We're not living in that kind of a world. So what do we do then? Well, I think we have to be realistic. And we have to say, what can we do in the one state that exists, and that is the state of Israel? What can we do to ameliorate as much as possible the relationship between the Jewish population and the Palestinian population? I think there's a great deal that can be done in that regard.
Thank you.
So that's a reflection of the fact that we cannot close our eyes to the facts of life. The changes have taken place, and we have to deal with them as they are, not as we would like them to be.
See, even rabbis have a hard time having a conversation about this topic. 90%, all the analysis that Rabbi Stanford gave, absolutely I agree. They just disagree on the conclusion.
I actually wanted to turn to a different topic. Good. And ask you, Rabbi Isaac. What have you learned, what did this congregation teach you about being a rabbi or about being a human being?
Wow.
Makes Israel look easy, right?
I found here, which I did not experience in my two previous congregations, an openness and a willingness to participate, an openness and a willingness to engage, to participate in the greater democratization of the Jewish community, whether that had to do with participating in reading Torah, or it had to do with an openness toward gay and transsexual individuals in our community, whether it had to do with how we deal with intermarried couples, how we deal with conversion, that this community really was open to all kinds of possibilities, which I found gratifying. And really, and something that was really wonderful for me.
Did that change how you did your rabbinic work?
Well, you know, the opposition that Rabbi Stanford talked about the turf, was not a kind of, now in a completely different area within the congregation, I didn't feel that. Perhaps the most controversial issue that I dealt with, and Rabbi Stanford began that conversation, was about an openness toward homosexual couples in the congregation. And when the Rabbinical Assembly, what year was that, 2004? Issued from the Committee on Law and Standards a kind of openness, a way of approaching the texts from Leviticus and Jewish tradition, and I started an adult education class to study the tshuva. Some of you may have been in that class. And what came to that class was not simply people who were open and to embrace the change, but there were those who I knew were hesitant, but they were willing to experiment, to try and see that this was part of a change, a development that has been happening. That have been happening in Judaism all along. So, for instance, when I came here, the Bima was up on the top of the stage. Although there was resistance, people said on the high holidays, I can't see, etc., we created a lower Bima, which is sort of symbolic of a increased participation that I have something to offer, but the congregation also has something to offer. In the Stanford Chapel, rather than having the chairs set up like they are here, in a kind of theater that they would be set up in the round, that people can see each other and participate with each other. I'm sure there are many other things. Well, I guess one of the other things, it never ceased to amaze me that no matter how many years I was doing the job of being a rabbi, there were always new questions that I never, ever imagined. And then would come up and, what do I do with this one now? There were a couple of times when I went to Rabbi Stanford and I said, what do you think about this? There were times when he responded to me, and I can think of one in particular, where a intermarried family in the congregation were prepared, they told me in advance, to have kippot from the for the bar mitzvah with a shamrock on the kippah to reflect, and I was a little uncomfortable about that. And I remember I went to Rabbi Stanford at that time, and I said, what do you think about that? And he said, do you know what kind of nonsense they put on kippot? From cartoon characters to baseball teams, he said, "What do you care?"
Political candidates,
and it was exactly the right response. But there were other times when I went to Rabbi Stanford and said, "You know, I never had a Rabbi Stanford before. I didn't have somebody I could even. I had my wife, but I didn't have a rabbinic colleague." And there were other times when I would come to him and I say, "What do you think about this?" And he would say, that's why you're the rabbi and I'm not.
Thank you. So I think we probably want to go to some questions on the cards at this point and get some thoughts or see where the congregation is at.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, now come the hard questions.
Okay.
So thank you for all the great questions. We probably won't get to all of them, but we'll get to as many as we can, and those that we don't get to, we'll try to bring into the Chronicle in some fashion and get some answers from our senior rabbis here. So
if there are yes-no questions, we'll get through a lot more of them.
We'll get through more of those.
No.
So this is for each of you, and if you could, I think the word succinctly comes back into play.
I don't think that word works, so you might want a different one.
What has been your greatest challenge? It feels like we're playing Trivial Pursuit here. What has been your greatest challenge during your rabbinate?
You're looking at me. I'm so new, it's hard to... I think just, you know, understanding and beginning to try to understand a very diverse community takes time. So part of the challenge just being here, being new, is what I am facing. There is also, and some of this came up, I worked in New York and I worked in Cleveland, and my congregations were filled with people who had often very rich Jewish backgrounds. In New York, I had probably 15 to 18% of my congregants had all graduated from the yeshiva of Flatbush. I mean, right? There was a tremendous amount of traditional Jewish knowledge. And one of the things that gravitated me to here in this congregation is the fact that that's not what the Jewish community looks like anymore. And what we're facing here is, I believe, what most of American Jewry will face. And that really are these questions of what does it mean to be a Jewish family? You were talking about the questions around LGBTQ individuals and how do we bring them in. I think for me, even more so than for you, Rabbi Isaac, the issue of what is a Jewish family in relationship to people's backgrounds. We have the notion of endogamy of in marriage is almost becoming antiquated in for so many young Jews, and what that means in terms of making sure that people live rich Jewish lives and that we can transmit that information and the tradition to them when there is not a lot of background is certainly a large challenge that is in front of me. But I'm going to keep that succinct and pass that on.
I can think of several. One thing that I would like, it seems to me that the Jewish community is engaged in a process of what I called before simultaneous centrifugal and centripetal force. That we have many within the Jewish community, not just in the Orthodox community, but throughout the community, many who are moving closer. If I had a show of hands, I'm not going to do that. How many of you are more religious than your parents? I bet you many, 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 many hands would go up. So that's part of the centrifugal force. But at the same time, there's a centripetal force that's sending Jews out into the stratosphere. And our challenge, it seems to me, is all those people that are sort of in between, that are in that band, that if left alone, that's really, in a sense, what our effort is in trying to welcome or intrigue Jewish families from the East Side. Because many of them are part of that centripetal force and our challenge is, how do we capture them? How do we keep them in? How do we keep them as proud Jews and participants in the Jewish community? Because there are all kinds of things that send people away. One of the things that sends people away is it's expensive to be a Jew. It's, you got to know it a lot to be a participant in the Jewish community. So there's a lot of reasons that people, maybe it was their parents, send people away. And the challenge is, how do we make a kind of a meaningful but attractive community that will bring those people in? I think that's the greatest challenge.
You know, it's taken us three generations to even have this meeting. It's a never-ending task.
This question is asking, what is the next big thing in Jewish Portland?
What's that again?
What is the next big thing in Jewish Portland?
Ah.
I think one of the, we've alluded it to, I mean, one of the questions for us certainly is how do we make sure that the resources are in place so that we can keep doing it? And the way that people view identity, the way people support is changing drastically. I don't know that that's something related just to Portland, but we certainly know millennial Jews are not, do not find their center of spiritual or Jewish identity necessarily connected with institutions, and yet at the same time, there's a little bit of something like herd immunity. If as long as enough other people are getting their inoculations, I'm okay not to be connected with Jewish institutions. But if too many people stop getting inoculated, then everyone ends up in danger. And I think that really is one of our challenges, as people don't want to be connected to a thing, a building, a place. How do we make sure the resources are there? How do we pay for the resources so that there can be meaningful transmission of our culture, of our values? How do we pay for it? And it's going to be take a lot, there's a lot of experimentation out that's going to take a lot of effort to try to solve that change.
Rabbi Stanford was the great institution builder. So many of the whether it's camp or a Holocaust Research Center or a film film series, somehow he was able to find the donors to create those institutions and to maintain those institutions. But now we're seeing a consolidation. I don't know that that's necessarily bad, but a consolidation of some of those institutions. And during that same time, we've had a great expansion of synagogues. How many synagogues, how many institutions ought a community of our size should we be able to sustain? I know that Ismar Shorsh, past chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, said often that while we talk about Israel being the great miracle of modern Jewish history, he said, as great a miracle as Israel is, American Jewry is a greater miracle. Because he says, in Israel, they actually have the power of coercion. They have the power of coercion because they can tax and they can create institutions. Here in America, everything that we've created in this community and every other community was done voluntarily. Yeah, there's tax deductions that people get for their donations. But nevertheless, everything that we've built within the synagogue and outside in the community is totally and absolutely a statement of our devotion and our commitment to the Jewish to Jewish life and Jewish survival. That's a great testament to our community. But the question is, I think you just mentioned it. How do we plan for the future? Is there a way for us, without getting into issues of turf, to really plan, go into the future planfully? I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
Well, I just like to make a few comments. In relation to the unusual nature of our meeting today. One of the feelings that I strongly have on a day like today is the opportunity to reflect on what Portland Jewish community was like 60, 70 years ago. What a long ways we have come. It's hard to believe that we have today, in terms of Jewish life, what we do have today. Just let me reflect with you about some of them, and you can add to the number that I'm suggesting with your own memories and thoughts. In 1960, I joined the faculty of Portland State University in the Middle East Studies Center. There again, there was some grumbling in the community in much the same way that I heard when I used to spend my 25 summers at Camp Solomon Schechter. He's our rabbi. What's he doing vacationing every summer at camp? What's he doing teaching at Portland State? A very small proportion of his students are Jewish. What's he doing being involved in this and that? But we look back at some of the totally unexpected blessings that we are now experiencing. We've had now, for so many years, a professor of Judaic studies at Reed College, Professor Stephen Wasserstrom, the most recent one, who every year in his courses reaches out to large numbers of Jewish and non-Jewish students and conveys to them unparalleled instruction in Judaica. In addition to that, we're so proud of the fact that at Portland State University, we have 4 full-time faculty members in a department of Judaic studies, where a student there can have a major or a minor in Judaic studies. We wouldn't have dreamt of anything like that 60 years ago. We're now in the process of acquiring and creating the latest phase of the Oregon Jewish Museum. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to see the new site, but you really are missing something if you don't take the time to go to Northwest Park and Davis and see the beautiful building that's going to house a wonderful Jewish museum. I remember when we started the Jewish Museum, we, strangely enough, prided ourselves that we were going to have a museum without walls. Isn't that lovely?
Museum without a building.
A museum without walls. Well, who would have believed that we would have the kind of museum that we are now actively completing and will be open to the public this coming May, I believe. I remember when we built this building, and especially when we remodeled it, and we built that very nice plaza right at the entrance that we all used to come in. Well, I would never have dreamt that I would ever see practically every day of the week dozens and dozens of Jewish kids, especially the boys with the tzitzis hanging out under their jackets, playing ball and coming into classes in Judaica. Now, they're not part of our synagogue activities officially, but they're here and they have brightened the community with their presence and with their learning. I would never have dreamt that I would ever drive down Beaverton Hillsdale Highway and watch people going in and out of stores with the garb so typical of Eastern Europe, buying kosher meat and kosher products all over Portland now. Portland was a desert for any observant Jew. It's changed so dramatically in so many different ways. We started Camp Solomon Schechter. Now there's a whole number of Jewish camps all over the Pacific Northwest. The Reform Movement has a beautiful camp in the state of Washington. Jewish life in the Pacific Northwest has been transformed. Let me, while I'm still talking in a microphone, tell you that on September 27th, there's going to be a book launch at the Oregon History Center downtown. And the name of the book is The Jewish Oregon Story, 1950 to 2010. Fascinating book, which sums up the extraordinary changes that have taken place just in these 60 years here.
Thank you.
You know, when I came to Portland, there were 8,000 Jews in Portland. In 1850, there were 8,000 Jews in Portland. You know how many there are today? All kinds of estimates, neighboring 40,000 Jews. So here we are, three generations representing that history for you. Thank you.
And you all have something in common. You all came to Portland to lead our congregation. So a question from the audience is, what is your favorite thing about Portland as a person who came here from another city? What do you like about the city of Portland?
A city in the forest. City in the forest.
This was the greatest move for my wife and for my kids. And if my wife is happy, then I can be happy. It really has been, my kids flourished in ways that I don't know that they would have flourished in the community that we were in before. And my wife, too, flourished through the museum and through her photography and through many of the other things. And while I was busy doing all kinds of things here, I could watch them, and I think that was the greatest piece, that the watching the flourishing of my family.
I'll jump back in, actually, because I gave the too pithy answer. I think that Portland, for me, feels like a place, and this congregation feels like a place, where I'm able to bring all the different parts of myself. And we've had a relationship now a little bit over a year, so you know at least there's a lot of different parts to me, and not every place is hospitable to that. So I feel very fortunate that I am able to bring the fullness of my being here. And like you, Daniel, this was Laura's fantasy place to live. And what guy doesn't want to make you fulfill his girl's fantasy?
Well, I wasn't sure that this was going to work out. Because my, although...
When are you going to figure it out?
My wife came with me for 1 year during rabbinical school in Israel, which to some degree was a disastrous year. She had never lived any place else but the New York metropolitan area. The museums, the theater, everything that's there. What would happen when I took her away and brought her here? There was great hesitancy. But we made it, and it was good for all of us.
Shikach.
With Rabbi Stanford mentioned the growth of the Jewish community, that also brings some other issues. And with current day anti-Semitism, what is your approach to addressing this, and why, and what can you share with all of us, and particularly those who might face growing anti-Semitism?
What a great and unfortunate question. You know, there was a little bubble, post-Soviet era Judaism, when we had taken care of it, where it seemed like, and you can read the leaders of the time, it looked like anti-Semitism was licked, if you can say that, right? It really looked like it could be a thing of the past. And what we have discovered, unfortunately, is that like a deep-rooted invasive plant, it pops up in new ways that maybe we could not foretell. The former chief rabbi of England talks about how anti-Semitism gets regarbed in the metaphor of the era. So in the age of nation states, right, Israel, well, in the age of religion, Jews were, all sorts of anti-Semitism was directed at Jewish religion, and we can track that in the Middle Ages. If you get to a later period, certainly it was against Jews as not having a nation. Now that there are forces that are imagining a post-nationalism, Israel is a throwback and is a horrible place simply because it is a nation state representing a particular bunch of people. So we see the over the last few days, a white supremacist, I talked about this on Friday night for those who were here, a white supremacist has been seen driving his highly painted car, which says on the back of it, Jew Lives Matter, up and down I-5. He's a well-known anti-Semite and white supremacist. So we see that it's coming up again, and I spoke earlier, what we're doing certainly for our 12th graders is going to be teaching them how, because on the college campuses, there is now a sophisticated attempt by those who hate the Jewish people to attack Israel beyond reasonable criticism, which certainly can be offered. And our job is to teach our youth how to listen to the arguments, how not to let their emotions get pulled in so that they can respond with dignity and with a sense of pride. We have survived as a people far worse, and we have survived because we understand how unique and wonderful this heritage is that we have been given. So in addition to those sorts of skills, we have to double down on passing down the particular education and values and openness to different points of view, which have been a deep part of the Jewish people through most of our history, and which I believe still is a type of role modeling that we need to do for the world as a whole.
My family was transformed because of anti-Semitism. My entire family came from Germany, and they all went in different directions. Some of them never made it. So that's my history. But I must tell you, I've met a lot of ignorance about Jews, but I've never been subject of anti-Semitism. I think that's pretty amazing that I don't know that I have ever personally experienced real anti-Semitism. A lot of ignorance, but in this country, now the college campus may be a different arena, but in this country, to this day, any politician that voices it may be different with our presidential election, but that voices anti-Semitic sentiments is finished. That has not been the case with people who voice racist sentiments. But David Duke started with it with anti-Semitism. He's still in there, but an anti-Semitic candidate in this country has no future. Now we have a separate issue on campus, and we have a separate issue in Europe, and we have a separate issue dealing with Israel. But and I don't have answers for those things. Educating our kids for dealing with different kinds of anti-Semitism, and it's also a matter of controversy. What really is anti-Semitism? What isn't anti-Semitism? We here in America, we have 40% of the world's Jews living in this country. Israel has another 40% of world Jewry. So there's another 20% that lives in France and the former Soviet Union and China and another South America. But for the most part, I think we're pretty secure. That may be a controversial statement, but I think that's true. Do you want to say anything about Okay.
Well, due to time, we've come to our last question, but before I ask it, just a reminder that dessert will be in Stanford Chapel after this, so please join us. And again, thank you for participating and coming today. The final question, and Rabbi Stanford, I'll start with you, and we'll work this way, is can you share your thoughts and hopes for the future of Judaism in Portland, and what do you wish for the most?
Well, my initial response would simply be to echo the words of the prophet Amos, "I am not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet." What we wish for, I think, though, the most is continuity, energy, and a sense of optimism. You know, there are so many reasons for us to be concerned about our future, but I think one look at all the accomplishments that are still going on ought to reassure us very much about the future. When I go to camp and watch all the kids there participating so actively in Jewish life, when I see the kids playing here in front of the synagogue or in the classrooms, when I walk into one of my classes, it's so renewing to see all the students that are eager to learn more about their history, their past, and their accomplishments. So all that I can say is, and it took me a long time to learn it, hold fast.
When I became a rabbi, a long time ago, not as long as Rabbi Stanford, but it was a long time ago. It was not unusual at a bar mitzvah for the father of the bar mitzvah, women weren't necessarily called to the Torah, but the father of the bar mitzvah not to know the Torah blessings. All grandfathers knew the Torah blessings. What happened as time passed is all of a sudden I had a series of bar and bat mitzvah celebrations where all of a sudden grandfathers didn't know the Torah blessings. And very often the fathers didn't either. I thought, how did that happen? Well, with the passage of time, those fathers who didn't know the Torah blessings were now grandfathers. But I look around and someone commented to me yesterday at this wonderful bat mitzvah that we had yesterday. And yesterday was certainly wonderful, but not unusual in how wonderfully prepared our kids are. Leading services, being familiar with the services, coming back to a to a sibling's bar mitzvah or to a cousin's bar mitzvah and reading from the Torah, parents spending the time to learn to read the Torah, people who weren't born Jewish leading services and reading the Torah. I think that's a great stands for optimism, because I think that many of our children, they're not necessarily graduates of the Yeshiva Flatbush. They are coming from a whole other vantage point. But I think there's a great deal for us to be hopeful for in terms of their desire and their feeling of competence in participating in Jewish life.
What I've learned in my short time here is that Portland has an enviable and unique history in that there was little anti-Semitism here historically, and moreover, that the Jews of Portland were communal leaders who helped build this city. That's a remarkable and an unusual statement for Jewish life in most of our history and most of the places we've lived. We might have been separate, but we've been intrinsically involved in civic life in the city, and we have a good reputation for that. So to build on the aspects of hope that Rabbi Stamfer and Rabbi Isaac mentioned, I'd like to see that continue in a few different areas. I'd like us to be, in the words of a different prophet, of Yeshayahu, of Isaiah, a house of prayer for all people. I'd like to see us continue to build on this fantastic culture of inclusion and openness to people of all different colors and outlooks and orientations and abilities. I'd like to see us be a house of prayer for all people, and that we recognize how much it looks different to have a Jewish family. I'd like to see us be involved as we are, and we have a wonderful Thanksgiving service planned on Wednesday the 23rd with three Abrahamic faiths. I'd like to see us continue that wonderful legacy we have of reaching out and building bridges and connections between the different parts of this community which the Jews helped to build. And I'd like us, if this is to be a house of prayer for all people, meaning that we welcome everyone in, I also want us to build the expectation that every house has rules, and that our rules in this place is that we are all striving to do a little bit better on the ethical sphere, on the moral sphere, but on the Jewish sphere also, that we should be learning and growing and deepening, regardless of where we started, regardless of what our background, that we are all traveling in that same direction, El Al, higher for higher. So with that said, I just want to say and ask you to join with me. Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael Chai. 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 Od Avinu Chai, Od Imanu Chai. Od Avinu, Od Avinu, Od Avinu Chai. Od Avinu Chai, Od Avinu Chai. Od Avinu, Od Avinu, Od Avinu Chai. Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael, Am Yisrael 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 Chai. Yasher Koach to Neve Shalom.